Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, we love to talk about current topics, and sometimes they deal with nuclear weapons. A lot of times they deal with nuclear weapons, but not always. And of course, Alex, the listeners may know Alex Littlefield. He's been on the NIDS View a number of times, and he joins me today along with Curtis McGiffin, whom you also know. But Alex sent me a couple of articles earlier this week, and he said, hey, let's talk about this back and forth between Tong Zhao and Ashley Tellis that took place in the pages of Foreign Affairs. And in the discussion, Tong Zhao wrote the original article and was attempting to explain why he thought the Chinese were expanding their nuclear arsenal. And for Zhao, he said it was counterbalancing, strategic counterbalancing, I think is the term he used, and that it wasn't a desire to use nuclear weapons against the United States, but it was that China did not want to be coerced any longer by the United States, and that nuclear weapons could, in the eyes of Xi Jinping, could reduce the amount of coercive ability the Americans had against the Chinese. And so, he also suggested it was somewhat uneven political reasons for this, that it wasn't necessarily well thought out and very clear strategy. And that was Zhao's take. And then Ashley Tellis, of course, writes a reply, and he says, no, I don't think that's what it is. It's Tellis has four main reasons. He says Beijing seeks to increase its force survivability. And this is an explanation for the numbers that they're going to and the types, the capabilities they're building. So survivability of the force. The second reason, and he had four, was increasing the retaliatory effectiveness of China's force. And then the third one was to increase China's escalation competitiveness, i.e. there's no place that the U.S. could go with nuclear weapons that China can't match. And then the fourth point was, of course, that Beijing would like to have the ability to more effectively regionally target Australia, Japan, South Korea, and, you know, of course, coerce and hold these countries at risk, and therefore deter American and its allies from intervening in, let's say, a Taiwan conflict. And that was Tellis's response. And then Zhao said, came back with a reply to Tellis and said, well, you know, I appreciate your take on these issues, but it does. I don't think that's why. And Zhao said, I think you, Tellis, Ashley Tellis, are optimistic about how strategic of thinkers, you know, the senior leadership of the PRC is. And I think there's a lot more disjointed political reasoning for this, and that it is, in fact, more haphazard and less, you know, sort of a uniform strategy. And that was the, you know, sort of the basis of this. And Alex, whom I'm going to go to first, Alex's take was they're both wrong. Both guys are just flat wrong. And for those of you that may not recall, Alex spent about 20 plus years, got his PhD in Taiwan, and lived in both Taiwan and China for over 20 years. And he used to, you know, hobnob with the princelings of the Chinese Communist Party. So he knows a lot of these folks personally, and they're the children of them. And he, you know, so he's familiar with Chinese elites, and he's like, hey, I don't think they understand them particularly well. So Alex, give us your rationale for why you think they're wrong. And then Curtis, I want you to jump in after that.
All right. I'm going to jump to the very end and have a spoiler alert.
Uh-oh.
And that is, I'm going to
the Butler did it.
Yeah, they both have the exact same conclusion, although they have different ways of getting there. And we'll talk a little bit about the back and forth and how they look at it differently. But the same conclusion is, in a very practical sense, for the U.S. to do nothing militarily. That's what Talis is saying. That's what Zhao is saying. The U.S. does not and should not have a military response to what China is doing. In the case of Zhao, it's because, well, the title is like the motives behind China's military buildup, and then the subtitle is Beijing seeks geopolitical leverage more than military advantage. Well, that doesn't tell us anything because, of course, the point of a military is not an end in itself. It's for some sort of geopolitical leverage.
Good point.
So,
that's right.
So that's like a no-brainer. Yeah, of course. So you're not telling us anything new. And when you go into the article, you actually, this is the conclusion. What is the actual motive and driver of China's seeking, military,
nuclear
more barrier. Leverage, whatever it is? It's fairness. They want what's more fair. And because this is a political problem and not a military problem, what's the response that the U.S. should take? Well, we need to address them diplomatically. So this is the conclusion, right? The takeaway: we as the United States need to sit down with China at the table and discuss what can we do to make you feel like this world order is more fair to you. So,
and how can we protect your interests?
What can
your legitimate interests?
Exactly. So that's a. I mean, for me as someone who's a bit more of a realist, that's a no go.
Mm-hmm.
Then let's go to Talis, and he basically concludes the same thing. He says, so this is where the two of them disagree. Zhao is saying like this is all just geopolitics, and a lot of it's in the mind and personality of Xi. And because it's psychological, political, whatever, we can address it through dialogue. Talis is saying, no, Zhao, you're a little bit wrong because actually there are military applications and reasons why they're doing it. And he has four, and we can go into that later. But then Ashley, Talis, his conclusion is China is just trying to catch up to us. We are a much greater, more powerful, stronger, threatening nuclear power. You got to allow China the space to catch up to us. So don't respond by trying to like somehow engage in a downward spiral of military buildup. So either way, we are supposed to just keep our hands off, stand back, and try and fix this through dialogue. But definitely, whatever you do, do not modernize your nuclear deterrent.
Or expand it for that matter.
Right, do not expand it. So these two people are saying the exact same thing in terms of their conclusions, although they come about it different ways.
Yeah, that's a compelling point. It's something I hadn't thought of, honestly, Alex. So high five, buddy, right there.
Yeah.
High five, way to go. Air five.
I can't see what's going on, as I said, so anyway.
Oh, okay, okay, right. Okay, so Curtis, now what's your take?
So, first of all, it's good to have Alex on the show. I couldn't agree with Alex's take more, to anybody's shock. But I think what frustrates me about this is there's this idea in this community, and I think these two are from the same community, judging by the conclusion of their individual of the piece and the response, which is, don't believe your lying eyes, right? Ignore the buildup, ignore the coercive capabilities that are being developed right in front of us, and then ignore your intrinsic responsibility to react and protect and defend your own interests and sovereignty. And then there's sort of this idea at the end that Adam and Alex, that we've never done before. It seems to these individuals that the United States, and specifically the Biden administration, has appeared to have no interest with meeting or with the Chinese leadership or negotiating with the Chinese leadership about anything, which of course we know is just utterly ridiculous, right? The United States of America is willing to talk with almost anybody, and it doesn't really matter how bad you are or how poorly you run your government or how autocratic you are. Or how many human rights you might violate, we're willing to sit down and talk to you if it means reducing America's nuclear threat. And note how I said that.
Let's be honest. I mean, America has a very strong tradition of sending missionaries around the world, and the high priests of the disarmament community who are graduating their disciples from their seminaries like Harvard, the Monterey Institute, and elsewhere, you know, and bringing them into the fold and into government so that they can then go out and, you know, transmit the one true faith of disarmament. Like you said, they are willing to do that with just about anybody who might embrace the faith. And so, therefore, it's got to be disappointing for the reception they've gotten by the Chinese, who have said, "We do not embrace your faith. We don't embrace it."
You know, and I appreciate the descriptive analogy, and I would say that there is no interest by the Chinese to negotiate anything that doesn't benefit their national interests. With regard to this capability buildup, and Zhao seems to be—I'm sorry if I mispronounce his name. Zhao. He really seems to be under the impression that there is no coercive desire by the PRC government to sort of change how they do business with regard to this new nuclear arsenal. They're creating this for a reason, and it is to increase their hegemony.
Do you see it the same, Alex? That they don't have that? Do you read Zhao the same in the sense that he doesn't see it as a coercive? You know, that he doesn't see any coercive desire on the part of the Chinese, or do you read it differently?
Yeah, I would say, not to put words in his mouth, but the spirit of the article is China is just seeking what is fair. And it's not coercion, but the implication is somehow the United States and the status quo is unfair to China. And my concern and question regarding that term status quo is, what status quo are we even talking about? Because I'd say ever after the EP3 incident, the status quo of the Pacific has changed dramatically with the...
That was, 2001, right?
2001. I'd say since 2000, whatever status quo there was, that has been in a trajectory of no longer being the status quo. So are we talking 2000 status quo? Or are we talking 2024 status quo? Because the status quo today is China claims everything that has water. Mm-hmm. And if you get into their water, they're going to punish you. You know, if you're Filipino, they're going to spray your boat, you know, drown, right. You know, drown you. They're going to, if you're a fisherman, if you're Vietnamese, if you're Japanese, it doesn't matter. You're in their swimming pool and you better get out of there. So that's the current status quo of 2024. So what is the status quo that China finds unfair? And what is the status quo that we as Americans need to be negotiating with the Chinese? 2024 status quo or future 2034 status quo, where maybe China and Taiwan are finally reunified, because that would only be fair after all?
Whoa. I'm going to stop you, Alex. Yeah. They've never been unified. There's no such thing as reunification. There was never unification.
All right. But we'll just say for the sake of argument. So anyhow, so if you're saying that they're unhappy with the status quo and it's unfair, then at least take the trouble to explain what that status quo looks like that we should be negotiating for.
So let me just add to that, Adam. I think it's an interesting point. Is the status quo of 2000, which is pre-World Trade Organization admittance, and any number of things is completely different than status quo today. And I think the world has accommodated the rise of China much to its own detriment under the current rules-based order. And this is what just sort of blows my mind is that, if anything, the current rules-based order has not been sufficient in ensuring that China plays fairly, I'm making air quotes, to within the world. And so I think to your point that what is the description of fairness? Is it symmetry? Is it parity? Is it fair share? Do they want their, is fairness defined as their fair share of the world? And how are they going to negotiate that, so to speak, with each of the other nations that are out there? Because there doesn't seem, while the Chinese government preaches sort of this divinity and community independence sort of stuff in their flowery language, the reality is that there is a hammer in that velvet glove, and they appear to be willing to use it on whenever they need to.
And Curtis, sorry, regarding the rules-based order, a rules-based order is meaningless if you don't enforce the rules.
Well, that's correct.
And that's what happened. When the Chinese started to take the atolls and, you know, start to build them up, and the U.S. and other countries said, no, don't do it, you're going to create bases and airstrips. And the Chinese said, no, we're not. So everyone just kind of sat on the sideline while the Chinese did precisely what they said they weren't going to do. But the U.S. should never have allowed all these things to happen to begin with. And when they kept breaking all the rules in the WTO, they should have said, okay, when you break the rules, these are the consequences. But they just kept coming back to the negotiating table. Keep coming back to the negotiating table. That was just the tried and the failed, tried and true, but in a negative sense. But it was the familiar and the comfort zone of the Americans. So that's what happens. You don't enforce your rules, you make them, you don't enforce them. So it basically becomes a no-rules world order.
And for anyone who's raised teenagers, take this for a lesson.
Go but ahead, Adam. Since the beginning of the existence of the, you know, the state of the People's Republic of China, we have allowed China to break the rules and to do pretty much whatever it wanted. Let's go back to, you may have forgotten, there was a country once. It was a sovereign country called East Turkestan, which is now the province of Xinjiang. And, you know, many Uyghurs there have been, you know, imprisoned, murdered, tortured. But that was a sovereign country in 1945. East Turkestan was a sovereign country. You may have heard of it. There was a country once called Tibet that was an independent country that was like East Turkestan, was invaded by the Chinese and was subsumed into China. Manchuria has historically been independent of China outside the Manchu dynasty. Let's look at Inner Mongolia, which was territory stolen by the Chinese. So the Chinese have this idea that, you know, peaceful rise and peaceful. It's never been peaceful since the very first day of its existence. The People's Republic of China has been invading and occupying its neighbors. Yeah. It's never been peaceful. And this is why I think it's important to make sure our listeners know this. Yeah. And then this idea of reunify. I hate the word reunify. Taiwan, if you look historically at Taiwan has never been a part of China. It's been, you know, it was Japanese, it was European, it was an island of pirates, it was an island of natives, it was all of these things. It was an island where the Hakka were pushed out because they got pushed out of China. It was all sorts of things, but it was never a centralized province of China. It wasn't. It never has been at no point. Yeah. And so this idea, and the, you know, the only time that the Han Chinese became a real significant portion of the population was when, you know, the KMT were forced off of mainland China in 1949. But before that, it was sort of this hodgepodge of different ethnic groups that were sort of outcasts of, you know, from Japan and China and aboriginals and all sorts of stuff. So the idea that China just wants its fair share. So was Tibet its fair share? Was East Turkestan its fair share? Was Inner Mongolia its what's not China's fair share?
Yeah,
that's more my question.
Right. So let me ask a question here as we move forward here. So Zhao talks about Beijing's pessimism from perceived U.S. double standards. And he notes the nuclear realm. But I think that there's a perceived double standard by the Chinese government in many realm parts, of, you know, many parts of the dime, for example. And when we look at it, says that they're frustrated with that the U.S. government does not accept that China has the right to adopt the same nuclear strategies as those of the United States. Is this an example, gentlemen, of a rejection of American exceptionalism in this case?
I just wanted to first backtrack a little to what Adam was saying when he was going through kind of China gobbling up the territory that was bordering its initial footprint on this planet. Basically, given the capacity and capability that they have, they take what they can get. And if no one's going to stop them, they're going to just do what they can. So even now, and they push the envelope. They continue to push the envelope, right? The border there with India, pushing the envelope. What they're doing now in the South China Sea, East China Sea, pushing the envelope. They will always continue to keep pushing. Mm-hmm. And as long as there's not a hard wall that they hit, it will just continue. It won't stop. So there's no end in sight to what is fair. That's a nice thing about this term fairness. You could eternally be trying to grab a hold of something that doesn't really exist in right. a concrete form of what is fair. Okay, so right. basically we could forever be at the negotiating table until we no longer even exist as a country, and still maybe in China's eyes we have not reached what is called fair.
Right.
Regarding
I was asking if China's rejection of what they perceive as a double standard by the U.S. is this a rejection of American exceptionalism?
Yeah, certainly. So they there should only be one exceptional country on this planet, and it's definitely not the United States. Ideally, there's one exceptional country, and every other country somehow falls in line and sort of, if you think of, what do they call it? The term escapes my memory right now, but the Caesarian kind of system where China is sort of, if you think of the old days of mercantilism, basically the highest end of the economy exists there in China, and everyone else is more or less a colony mm-hmm, or a mm-hmm. tributary state. That's the word.
Yeah, tributaries.
Tributary state of China. So the U.S. should not be exceptional. It should just become another tributary state of China. And you see that slowly happening over time, right? So now Chinese own lots of farmland in the United States.
They need the
rest of the world for resources.
Alex, mm-hmm. how much farmland do Americans own in China? I can't remember the exact number.
Yeah. So nobody owns any farmland in China, including
Chinese farmers. but yet we're allowing them to buy up tens of thousands of acres of farmland. Oh, and the best farmland is next to American military bases. For some reason, I didn't know that, but apparently it's, you know, best farmland is close to American military bases.
Yeah. American nuclear weapons are good for crop growing.
Apparently so.
Beat me to it. It's the radiation. It's you know, you get these giant squashes and potatoes.
So let me ask you, Alex and Curtis, and because this is one of the questions, it's sort of like the question, you know, one of the fundamental questions I wonder is like, why do people believe that nuclear weapons are expensive when they're, you know, less than the amount of waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid? You know, that's a perennial question I wonder, like, how are people so misguided? But my other perennial question that I wonder is, how do people even today still think that China is anything other than an aggressive, ambitious state that seeks to do what it has been doing since 1949, gobble up everything around it? I think that the South Koreans sort of understand this. The Japanese get this. The Vietnamese understand it. You know, the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, the East Turkestanis, they understand it. But why do we in the West and in the U.S. and in Washington D.C. you're a D.C. you're a Beltway person, Alex. Why do your people not get it?
Those are two separate but related questions. The first is kind of a question of priorities. So why would we say that X amount of dollars on nuclear deterrence is expensive, but not X amount of dollars on, say, some social service?
Well, just let that one go and answer my second one. Why don't you and your D.C. people understand that China is all these things I just said it is?
I just want to tie them together, though.
Go ahead.
You see, like in this, so living, I literally live on the Hill, and there are, you'll see posters that'll say things like, I haven't seen them lately, but books, not bombs. And the idea is that whatever bomb we buy, that's one less person who could get the health care they deserved. That's one less child who didn't get the education they needed. And only these very corrupt, warmongering, bloodthirsty, crazy, crazy people in this country would ever suggest that we need to put more money towards nuclear deterrence and take that away from the children and the people who need health care. Which then comes to the second thing regarding threat. In their mind, United States and a powerful United States is not a good thing anyhow. We should be a very Swedish style welfare state, whatever, taking care of our people, not provoking China, not provoking anybody. We need to defang ourselves, declaw ourselves until it gets to the point that we have these rich man problems of where we, the things we debate and the things we prioritize show that we have no sense of vulnerability, no understanding of what it means to be vulnerable, what it means that we could actually lose us all in a week, so that we would be, what just happened here? We just got blindsided, but people like us on this NIDS view have been saying, we told you so, we told you so, we told you so.
Yeah, good point. Curtis, what's your take?
I think, for me, it all comes down to the mighty dollar or the yuan or whatever currency you want to use. We've been so blind with capitalism, and to some extent, I don't mean to sound like I'm a grubby socialist here, but the investment in capital that we've invested in China has really created the burden that we have now. And this is why I've always advocated for really not trading with our likely adversaries. And if you don't want to call them an adversary, why are we trading with our pacing threat? Why do we give them advantages? Why do we accommodate and appease in different ways our pacing challenge? And when you look at even the defense budgets, I mean, Admiral Aquilino, before he retired out of being the SINCPAC commander, that's probably an old term, I guess, Indo-PACOM commander. I'm sorry, I had a little 1980s glitch. I've been reading too much of the 80s right now. It basically said, hey, I'm $11 billion short in my deterrence mission. While we were debating giving $65 billion to Ukraine. But it is Russia that is the acute threat, and it is China that is the pacing threat. See, our resourcing doesn't even match with what we need. We're talking about our inability to build sufficient numbers of submarines, the debate that we don't have enough bombers, which we might need for longer range reach, even if you're not using nuclear weapons, we as Americans, as far as policy strategy, we are just so confused here as we look at what we say versus what we do. And case in point, we work very hard to tamp down the rumblings in South Korea to organically develop their own nuclear weapons. And then Putin sweeps into North Korea and signs a treaty, a defense pact, if you will, with Kim Jong-un. Well, that just has raised all the cackles of the South Koreans again. They're no longer assured. And when we look at our just today, that it was noted in the press that the Chinese have now officially rejected any agreements to keep artificial intelligence out of the nuclear arsenals. So China's not interested in seeking some sort of negotiation back to some sort of status quo that puts them back at 200 weapons. And so we need to realize that and stop this idealistic dream that somehow we're going to change their minds. They're wealthy enough to achieve a dream, and they are hell-bent on achieving a dream, whether it makes sense to Zhao or not. And I'll just point out one small fact here as we're wrapping things up. Zhao rightly says that they raised their nuclear arsenal from 200 warheads in 2019 to 1,000 warheads by 2030 is the plan. That's a 500% increase in essentially 10 years. If the United States were to execute a 500% increase, our warhead count would go to 7,750. So if we're going to talk about fairness, Alex, with the Chinese, perhaps our fairness should be is that we should raise our arsenal at the same percentage rate that they are.
Yeah, it's a good point. So, you know, as we wrap up, because we're out of time, let me just encourage the listeners to Google Triad Symposium, because NIDS, along with Louisiana State University Shreveport and the BRF, just hosted last week the Triad Symposium. And Chris Yaw and myself had a discussion at that symposium where Chris talks specifically about real estimates of Chinese nuclear weapons. And the numbers that he suggests the Chinese have are more than double what they actually are being, what we're being told they have, because he breaks them into tactical or theater weapons and strategic. And he says the 500 is more or less accurate for the strategic, but for the tactical, they have at least double that. And so Google that and watch at least that first one, that first discussion. That was a good one. And then watch the rest if you want. And of course, if you want to, you know, read about these topics, you can, you know, Global Security Review is NIDS's premier publication. So go on there. And if you really feel like it, we'd love for you to write an article. If you've got some expertise in an area, write an article for us. And then, of course, if you go to the Think Deterrence Twitter feed, then, of course, Curtis is putting great articles up every single day and great commentary, so you can get more and you can interact with Curtis because he's our Twitter or our X-master.
I'm the social media guy.
And, you know, we're on LinkedIn, so follow us there.
That's right.
And then, of course, you can always reach out to Alex because Alex manages the HUC events, because we every 2 weeks, right, Alex? It's every 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah, roughly. Sometimes more.
We do what we call a HUC event, and we're starting to do more live events in D.C. And so some of them are virtual and some are live, but get on Alex's list and he'll invite you to listen and participate in those and, you know, interact with the National Institutes for Deterrent Studies. And we're always looking to hear from you. We're always looking for great topics, and we, you know, reach out and, you know, we'll see what we can come up with for the next week's podcast. So of course, gentlemen, thanks for another great discussion.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Alex. It was a good topic, Alex. Thanks for bringing this one up.
That was a good one.
You know, the only thing I was going to say to end it out was I don't necessarily care why the Chinese ultimately did it. Is it internal politics? Is it well thought out or not well thought out? Is it a Chinese master plan? I don't care. It still presents the same threat to me in the United States.
That's right.
And therefore, I have to deal with it, regardless of why. Because the simple fact is the Chinese are not the British or the French.
That's correct. Their intent is hostile.
And so they're, yeah, we can't just assume a benign purpose and therefore do nothing.
And may I add one thing quickly to the
go for it, Alex.
Sure. The So Tong Zhao's response to Ashley Tellis when they finally, you know, when he had a chance to respond to the response, he says that his article was pretty much to urge Washington to avoid, I'm quoting here, defaulting to worst-case scenario thinking and to strive for the most realistic threat assessment possible. But that's it. The most realistic threat assessment would be more or less worst-case scenario. But
that's
we're right. supposed to know. We're not supposed to worst-case scenario. Why would we even go there? Why would we want to wish that into existence? But by pretending it's not there and by pretending it doesn't exist just makes it all the more likely to happen because we promote peace, and peace comes by preparing for war. It comes by deterring your enemy. And when you don't deter your enemy, they're going to take advantage of your naivety.
That's right.
That's a good point. And when America wasn't prepared for World War I, World War II, or other wars, it went great. And so not being prepared, you know, kept the Germans from attacking the West twice, right? No, wait a second. I remember that.
But
wrong.
I think your history
They did
wrong.
Attack. Yeah, they did attack. Right, I forgot. So preparation is key, not a lack of preparation. Who would have ever thought that? Okay.
You're not going to start talking about the Nazis bombing Pearl Harbor, are you?
I'm not. I did have I was teaching a class once at, I won't say where because it's my alma mater, and one of the students in the class says, "Who won World War II?" And everybody started laughing, and I was standing up there teaching, and I was just trying not to laugh. But, you know, that's the modern education system
there we go.
For you. So, all right. Well, Alex, Curtis, thanks once again. Great discussion. And, of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. We're always glad to have you. Reach out anytime. We'll get back to you. And, of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.